Okay, so we are being recorded now. So I'll ask again, are there announcements?
I sent out the email about the NSTEA Climate Charathon. So I hope people are signing up and getting that session full of good stuff. It, based on my experience. Yeah, this is Indianapolis. Based on, this will be the first year that they have, it's a climate and atmosphere, and it's the first year that NESTA has that charathon. But last year I was at the geology charathon, and I think I saw about 200 teachers in that hour session.
I know you sent out the email. Do you want to just describe, do you want people to send things to you, or how do people sign
up? No,
out?
I don't want people to send things to me. I can, I definitely don't.
we hear you.
There's an online form in that email where you can sign up to be a participant in the charathon, and all it asks for is who you are and a brief description of what you've got to share. And the basic idea is you hand out stuff to teachers who circulate through the room. The room is, it's a big like ballroom with tables set up around the outer perimeter with folks behind the tables handing stuff out. So you just prepare a handout, prepare a couple of hundred of them. and teachers
and when
will
is the climate?
I don't remember what time it is.
Okay.
I
know I just got in the mail my confirmation of my session at NSTA, so.
Yeah, I just got mine too, which I haven't even opened yet.
Is there a deadline?
I don't, if there's a deadline, it's not terribly, terribly soon, but of course, the sooner you do it, the sooner it'll be taken care of and checked off your list.
There you go, yes. Okay, thanks a lot. All right, any other announcements? I guess I want to remind people that for the Clean Pathway Project, we're having monthly these professional development interactive webinars. So it's 2 hours online and on the phone focused around a different climate literacy center principle. We've had four, and the next one is January 19th. We have not sent registration out for that yet, but just keep it in mind. It will be focused on climate literacy essential principle number 5, which has to do with observations and modeling. So you can keep that in mind. Okay, any other announcements? All right, well, then we will move on to our presentation for today. As most of you know, there are a group of projects funded by NSF, the Climate Change Education Partnership Phase 1 projects, and we've been working to have each of them present what their effort is on our call to both inform the Climate Literacy Network and to provide connections potentially for those different projects with people in their regions or within their topical domain. So this is one of those talks. John Anderson will be talking about his National Network for Ocean and Climate Change Interpretation. And he is the Director of Education at the New England Aquarium, where he works on developing various educational programs for the range of audiences that you would have in aquariums, school groups, families, teenagers, teachers, and is leading this national network focused on climate change in the ocean. So, John, I will turn it over to you. If you haven't already, his slides are posted on the website, so I'm assuming everybody has those slides.
Tamara, thank you, and thanks to everybody for jumping on the call and for your interest in the project. And I'm hoping that I can orient you and that in the discussion you'll have good ideas and suggestions, and perhaps, as Tamara mentioned, maybe there's some cross linkages here that we haven't made yet that this call can help us to do. So, to preface speaking about the Nyaki project, as I pronounce the acronym, I see the work we're doing with aquariums and zoos and others as being embedded in a much larger social framework. There are business efforts, there are grassroots efforts, there are engineering efforts. There's all kinds of there are people from multiple sectors at multiple levels of organization working to find ways to address issues of climate change. And I see that the public conversation has tended to be, and by the way, I don't think I'm saying things that are new for you, but this is the context of the work that we're trying to do. The public conversation tends to be really polarized. It tends to be politicized, and that's not necessarily constructive. So we, as an aquarium, came at this thinking, what could be the role of aquariums and our colleague institutions in trying to do something that's more positive, that gets people engaged? And so our approach has started by working with aquariums. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see this slide represents just 40 aquariums. It doesn't have any zoos included. It's not every aquarium, but I picked a list that I could pull together quickly and asked a colleague that's a GIS specialist, could you map these and give an indication of the percentage of the U.S. population within about a two-hour drive? And so those bubbles just show you the reach that aquariums potentially have. And again, this is not all the aquariums and not all the zoos. And so I think given that our audiences tend to see aquariums and zoos and museums as having authority, having good information to share, they tend to trust us. That gives us an opportunity to reach a great deal of people. Our collective audience is huge. If we can connect climate information and spark dialogue that stays productive, that stays empowering and not discouraging or leading to that idea that it's just about politics and there's nothing that matters to me. So we are trying to find ways to tap that possibility and create things that are actually influencing conversations and helping people to take information and internalize it as meaningful for them in their lives. So what difference? The next slide is about, you know, just sort of thinking about what difference we could make. And I've alluded already to the idea that we want to help people make meaningful, salient, inspiring, and empowering information about what's going on in our world that scientists studying climate, atmosphere, oceans are figuring out and have been for a very long time, as we all know. One note I'd point out, some of you may be familiar with the work of a social scientist named Kurt Lewin, who worked with Margaret Mead back during the World War II era. And Margaret Mead led a project, and one of the pieces was to say, if we need to preserve our meat supplies to feed the troops overseas, what could we do to get families to shift and stop eating so much beef so we could direct it to the troops? And Lewin essentially quickly figured out that men weren't making decisions about what to eat at home, women were. So he said, let's study how women make their decisions. And then he did control groups where he had groups of women that had experts testify to the health benefits and the economic benefits of eating a variety of different kinds of meat, including organ meats and poultry and pork. And then, so that was one kind of study group. And another kind of study group was simply given the challenge, what could you do to change your eating habits with regard to meat? And what they found is that the women who were in a social group that was a peer group that took on the challenge themselves, they actually made a lot more change than people with all kinds of information. And that kind of research, or similar sorts of research, have shown us over time repeatedly that information, disseminating information, is insufficient to get people to change their behaviors. And, you know, of course, we know this from smoking. We know this from lots of different sources. So it's important, I think, for us to stimulate dialogue that's constructive and stimulate it among people who are making decisions for themselves and their communities. So I think the role aquariums and zoos and museums and maybe and national parks may be able to play is to stimulate those conversations, to seed the question of what can we do about these issues. So I'm going to present the next slide. What's the challenge? So if you saw an image like this and you were visiting an institution like ours, what might you think? And if you click ahead, these are some of the things that you might think. And actually I have to see what the PowerPoint looks like. Okay, so is everybody muted?
Yes.
No.
No.
Some people are, some people aren't.
All right. Well, not you don't have to stay muted because you may. I mean, sometimes I've shown this slide and I get a laugh or two. And when everybody's muted, it's sort of disconcerting. But the idea is, you know, people do come to aquariums and they come to see pretty fish and then they think, oh, well, have I seen that somewhere before? And maybe I need a vacation. But if you go to the next slide, you get a sense of what like people think. There's a dog in the background.
Whoever has a dog, can you move? Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. So so you can see the challenge. When people approach an exhibit on their own, they are more likely to focus on just what they see and maybe where they've seen it before or where they'd like to go or something very personal and not. Seeing an exhibit isn't necessarily orienting towards a larger view of the world that we're part of. And I think another way of stating the challenge is how can aquariums and our fellow institutions help people to encounter themselves in the picture when they are looking at an exhibit, and that the exhibit is a slice of our world that we share and not simply something on the other side of the glass. So that's the challenge. And our strategy on the next slide, you see a group of people that was the group involved in our first, what we called a study circle. And this group met 3 times for 2 days over 6 months. And we met with colleagues from the Frameworks Institute. And so we worked and learned together over that time. And we are currently in the middle of our second study circle. So the general idea is, to gather facilitators of education at multiple institutions and engage them in a learning process that looks at both communications theory and also at oceanography or climate science. And we're partnered with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and in each of our study circle groups, the plan is, and we have had PhD students studying oceanography or some part of it, affiliated with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. So clicking to the next slide, you see some people practicing. This is at an aquarium, and they were actually pretending to be visitors and pretending to be an interpreter. And they did this a bunch of times to try and find ways to actually make those broader connections. So again, next slide is back to the group. We're working at the interface of communication practitioners, people are talking with visitors at institutions like ours. We're working at the interface of Frameworks Institute, which studies or draws on studies from a number of social science and cognitive science disciplines, including linguistics, cultural anthropology, psychology. They look at a variety of evidence. And we're also working at the interface of the professional ocean and climate science community and trying to hold a group together over time with content and practice involved. So that's our general approach. I'm going to speak a little bit about recommendations, and these are really recommendations through the learning theory that's coming from Frameworks Institute. So if you're on the slide that has a picture of the Earth and says value, issue, and story, Historically at aquariums, we tend to foreground the fish so that we tell the story of the fish, its adaptations, its, people ask about how fast does it swim or how long does it live or what does it eat. And we've tended to really focus most of our time there. And the recommendation is to find ways to not eliminate that piece, but to foreground the idea of the global view or a much broader level geographic view, timescale view, and move from the global to the specific. And this middle image here is supposed to represent the Phoenix Islands, where there's one of the largest marine protected areas in the world. And so we move from the idea that we share a big system, that people can figure things out, like creating marine protected areas, in this example only, this is merely illustrative, and that then the animal in front of us is connected to those larger stories. So in very broad strokes, that's what we're trying to learn to do. So which values matter is the next slide. And Frameworks Institute has recommended four major values that they expect based on their previous work, and they haven't specifically tested these in their full-blown research methodology. But based on prior research, their expectations is that connecting our audiences with the idea of innovation, that Americans are innovators, that we have the possibility of inventing new kinds of solutions, that's likely to be a useful way to engage people and keep the engagement positive and productively focused. Similarly, interconnectedness, the idea that our fate is connected with the fate of oceans and land ecosystems, that we're part of one larger interactive system with water involved, with energy involved, with us and our decisions and our social decisions involved. That interconnectedness is another thing that Americans tend to value that we could connect to and help orient our conversations. Responsible management is the idea that we grow up wanting to take care of problems. From a young age, we're told, most of us are told, leave it better than you found it, clean up your mess, pick up your toys, and as we get older, that those messages get more less classroom oriented, but they're very clearly there. We talk all the time about fiscal management, fiscal responsibility, this idea of identifying a problem and then seeking solutions to it in order to be responsible is pretty core to a lot of Americans. And similarly, stewardship, which tends to have a religious or theological kind of interpretation for many people, is similar to responsible management, but for many Americans, it may be grounded in the idea that creation is something from a larger, higher power, and we need to respect and honor and protect something. So these are orienting values that are likely to be useful. So starting with the values and then moving to the issues, there are a number of issues, and it's important because in our society we're deluged with information that we probably need to pick one at a time rather than taking on everything. So maybe you're focusing on sea level rise, maybe ocean acidification, maybe extreme weather events. If you're talking with public audiences and trying to connect your exhibit to the larger picture, trying to do all of it at once may be overwhelming, and we may be better off with one. These are samples of issues, not an exhaustive list. And then what's the story? So again, we want to connect back to our exhibits. And I've moved a slide, and I'm going to move one more. I think we could encapsulate it this way, and this I don't mean to be prescriptive. This is a generality. But it's a story about people who are trying to solve problems, who recognize that as we look at the world, help is needed, and they're doing things to address the disruptions that affect the animals that we can see here, that affect us as well as the animals that we see here that we're connected to. That's a gross oversimplification, but I think helping interpreters to learn to do that could be valuable. What's the story? Our protagonists recognize they're in it. Our visitors, our interpreters, ourselves, people we're in dialogue with, we all burn fossil fuels. Carbon dioxide is released when we burn fossil fuels, and it's released to the atmosphere. When it's in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide acts like a blanket that traps heat. Trapping the heat heats up the temperature of the Earth, and there are consequences to that temperature rise. So that's a piece of the story. In frameworks parlance, we call this a causal chain, the idea that very often in our communications we hear carbon dioxide is bad, so use renewable energy. And there's no connecting the dots in many communication examples, and frameworks has really encouraged us to find ways to connect the dots. So explain that fossil fuels burning them releases carbon dioxide and so forth. And in doing that, we can help our audiences orient towards solutions. And the next slide is the story points towards solutions. So I've talked about that. I'm going to pause for just a second and see if people have questions at this moment.
I just wanted to comment that I think your perspective here, this is Dan Barstow, your perspective is a very healthy and positive one. And, you know, we've had dialogue the past few days about, you know, I think it was framed as kind of the Christmas or holiday conversations about how do we communicate about climate change and, you know, different ways of conveying the message. But, you know, your tone here, I think, is acknowledges that the more we make this into a battle over the believers and the non-believers, the harder is our Sisyphean uphill climb. Whereas framing it as you've articulated and looking at those core values, I think it's a fruitful, a lot of insights that you've just given here that deal with that challenge.
Thanks. I find that very reassuring that you are taking my remarks that way. I hope that plays out to be true in practice as we develop more people who are good at doing this. And I should say that interpreters who we've been working with and learning with, they aren't finding it actually easy to do all of what I'm trying to describe succinctly. It's not easy to actually do in practice. So I think there is a lot of learning that we need to do in our community. But I hope that, and I'll go through a few more slides here, but I hope that you are stimulated to think about these challenges in ways that we can shape the dialogue to be productive and not argumentative. I think that's the argumentativeness, I agree with you, is not necessarily going to get us where we need to get to. Dan, thanks.
This is Tamara. Another thing, sort of along similar lines here, is that we have this project with the University of Massachusetts Lowell, in which students who have spent time in a course learning the climate science, but then another piece of it is communicating it to a broader group. One of the things that they began to realize is how, and it sort of reflects the issues you said with some of the people in your circle, I forget what you actually called it, where they were, they found it not easy to try to communicate this sequence of ideas. The same thing is that both the group of college students that were charged with trying to communicate through a media piece, what they had learned, and sure they were to create a 60-second piece, and they really struggled with the exact words that should be in the sentence to accurately and compellingly convey these ideas. And it was the same thing with the high school student. This program has both college students and high school students acting in these roles. To even the high school students who struggled to learn the science, but once they then grabbed onto a piece that they could own and trying to communicate it to a broader group in a way that really got across the message was really a challenge. And I think that's what you're describing here also.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And I think I'm going to go on to the slide that has simplifying models at the top. And this comes out of Frameworks research several years ago, where they very carefully with focus groups or what they call talkback groups, they shared a variety of different models to see which ones result in people talking sort of more constructively, more positively about what can be done to address the issues. And the idea of the heat trapping blanket clearly emerged as being more powerful than the greenhouse effect. They also found, as many of us have found, the greenhouse effect cues up confusion with ozone and ozone hole. People think if it's a greenhouse and there's a hole in the roof because of the ozone hole, then, you know, it lets out the greenhouse gases or something. I mean, people get all kinds of confused. So the heat trapping blanket metaphor seems to be very powerful for people.
And John, the research just backing up this interpretation model that you're coming up with, this is through this Frameworks Institute?
Yes, I think we can selectively, they haven't published it. It was, a lot of the research was done under contract agreements and it was proprietary, so they didn't publish it really widely. They reported on it. I have some of those papers, but they have not been through a full public peer review process. So I'd welcome you to...
Is that in the works? Is that in the works? Is that part of the
I'm not aware that it is directly in the works. I think it should be, but...
In this age of... I mean, this logic, too, has also been... I guess I'm a little bit surprised that it's not open source at this stage of our lives.
Let's not go down that road. I essentially agree with you. Nonetheless, we have the benefit of getting the messages of it, and I can say that in my experience, which is anecdotal, of course, the heat trapping blanket metaphor has been very useful. I have found it to be functional in conversation to keep people engaged, and it's pretty easy to, you know, once you hear it, it kind of sticks, which is also useful. So some summary recommendations: start with a big idea, clearly state the problem and solutions, or clearly point to solutions. Use clear metaphors, and I've listed one that seems to be powerful. Indicate who's responsible, and generally that's all of us. And connect the dots so we're not pointing fingers at the fossil fuel industry, but not having any explanation of why that has anything to do with the issue we're talking about, which I think if we look at a lot of communications, we've been doing that as a broader field. There are other recommendations that I really haven't talked about in this presentation so far, which is avoiding myths and misconceptions, being very careful with statistics. They can be powerful, but they can also be misunderstood very easily. So the concept of social math is one we've been trying to work with. Dan's commented that my tone is positive, not argumentative, and the idea of using a calm and optimistic and professional tone is important in dialogue. Of course, images and props and animals have power and can be useful for attracting attention and holding people in conversation who might rather walk away, and also helping to clarify ideas. And if we do this, our communications well, the audience should be able to answer the question, what is the problem, who's responsible, and where can we find solutions, or what solutions are available?
This is Tom. I have a question about these one, in particular, the first one about staying away from misconceptions. Do you mean to stay away from even addressing them and helping people rectify their misconceptions?
Or yes, as
talking
I
about them. Go ahead.
As I understand it, the research. There is research that suggests if you present a misconception and then knock it down or explain why it's a misconception or a myth, the effect is very often to reinforce the myth or misconception. So communicators are better off simply explaining what is more accurate and avoiding any discussion at all of the myth or the misconception.
Okay.
And this group, I would be surprised if nobody, there are probably people on the line who are more expert at that than I. But I think that's worth reminding
ourselves. Don't think of an elephant.
Yes, you say that again?
Don't think of an elephant.
The images stick. Patient
lingo.
Yeah.
Of communicating, if you want, I'm supporting your proposal of what to focus on. Because if you put the misconception out, it reinforces it.
So, yeah, I guess if people want to discuss that some more, we can do that. When I've been interpreting in my history horseshoe crabs, there's a myth. So I'm doing exactly what I'm telling you not to do. Many people find them are afraid they're dangerous, and so I don't talk about that. I simply put my thumb against the point of the horseshoe crab's tail and say, it doesn't hurt me, and just show the truth of it and invite other people to feel that themselves so that they have the positive body, physical, kinesthetic experience that it's not dangerous. To use an example from a totally other field, a different scale. Let's see. There's... couple more slides here. Just there, we have been trying to assess and doing. We've been doing formative assessment as we go, so we're learning about how to facilitate bringing together these communities of practice or these study circles. And we have found that people increase their confidence. They are getting some of the core ideas. They are developing their skills for practicing, even as they find it difficult. We have had requests for training, so that to me is a sign that something's moving out from our work that other people are interested in. And we've also had positive feedback from participants that they are finding it useful and valuable. And one of the orientations we brought is the idea that this should be connected with people's work that's ongoing and not simply an extra. It's not like a course that's unrelated to your daily work for the people who are in the group. It is informing. We aspire for it to be informing what they're doing anyway. There are also some challenges on the next slide, and some of these have shifted for members of the group as they've learned. Fear of confrontation is something that came up a lot in our early experience. It's coming up a little less these days, but a lot of interpreters expressed that they were reluctant to engage with climate change-related content because they expected they'd get a lot of pushback from their visitors. In some cases, they're afraid of pushback from their institutional leadership or their board, and so securing institutional support in some cases is really critical in order to even engage in this kind of conversation. Also, given the challenges of learning to practice and make the practice part of our work, sustaining the effort, the learning effort over time is something that we keep finding that we need more time. 6 months is good, but even at the end of 6 months, people are express desire to keep going. And another thing that I think our field needs is models. People often ask me, okay, so when an interpreter is succeeding at doing all the things that we've just been talking about, what does it actually look like? Can you show me a script that's a really great example? Can you show me a video of somebody doing it? And frankly, we are struggling to capture those moments. A lot of it is happening organically, and we're finding it really challenging to capture on video. And of course, if we have visitors involves we also need to have permission. And if you're seeking permission, then you disrupt the naturalness of the interaction. So I'm continuing to put out the call for people to provide examples in a variety of ways, which could include you've just had a good interaction, take a few minutes to jot down notes, and then share those notes so we can build a collection of examples for others to learn from and spread the learning outward from these initial groups.
John, are you getting any data from the visiting public in terms of just visitorship response to interpretation and so on?
We are just starting to roll out a test of the metrics to gather that data. I think the answer is we don't have any data in hand at the moment, but we are at a point where I think we've got a research plan to begin gathering that data and evaluating it, and we should have at least some preliminary data in another few months.
Good, great.
So, looking ahead, I think there's power in the approach that we're taking. In fact, it's a little bit like these phone calls. You've got a community that's sharing practices and discussing them on a regular basis. And in some ways, I think that's got a lot of similarity. Holding the community together over time is important. I think continuing to build the community so that we can develop a sense of who's particularly skilled, who's working at the interface of exhibits and visitors around this content. And as we develop a larger cadre of those people who are really skilled and gifted with it, they can become models for more people who are learning to do it well, and that's a community of practice model. So going forward, I'd like to be able to organize more of these learning groups and to be able to facilitate ongoing support and cross linkages between the groups so they have a core cadre of people they know pretty well, but they also realize and know who are in the larger community wrestling with this. I think that could help us, again, in that broader context of multiple projects coming from multiple sectors. I think that could make a contribution to the broader public conversation.
John, this is Caroline. I just need to ask, is NAI at the table at all? And who on earth are these Frameworks Institute folks? Are they a for-profit? Are they like Eco America? Who are they?
Frameworks Institute is a nonprofit consulting group that does research and consults on communication challenges, and they have a really good website. Their founder and president is a woman named Susan Bales.
I'll check that out. It is a nonprofit.
Yeah,
wonderful.
It is a nonprofit, and they do most of their work is funded by foundations.
Right.
They've not done a lot of government contracts. In fact, this project is, well, I don't know all about their funding, but I know that they've worked primarily with foundations over the years.
So you hired them, or you contracted with them to work with you on the Aquaria project?
Correct.
And are they associated with NAI, the national, for those of you on the line, the NAI is the National Association for Interpretation, and they have annual conferences and so on, and I think that their platform should be, do you use it, John?
Yes. in fact, I've worked closely with Jim Covell, who was the president for a year or so of NAI.
Right.
He's at Monterey Bay Aquarium, and we've worked with him and some of his colleagues quite a lot. We have not formally partnered with NAI, but many of my colleagues have been trained with NAI. They're certified interpretive guides, certified by NAI. So we definitely have a conversation between NAI's approach and recommendations from frameworks as we are interpreting them.
Good.
And I agree with you that's an important cross-linkage, and I think it can be developed more
Yeah, I love your tone, John. I think the whole idea of putting as many people under the umbrella as possible, but understanding, you know, who's doing what and how do we wrap our arms around these best practices or these, you know, nuggets of strategy that are coming out and, you know, showing from the research that they are effective. I think it's really important that we do that. I am from the public garden world, John. I'm on the board of the...
You're from the public gardens?
Yeah, I'm a American Public Garden Association. I'm on the board. I work at Pinecrest Gardens at the Clio Institute. So we're doing the same thing at the public gardens level with our MOU on climate change with NOAA. And I'm listening to you thinking, you figured out a lot of the best practices on interpretation and definitely don't want to reinvent the wheel here. So I'd like to take an offline call with you at some point, John, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. And I'm sorry, I missed your name.
It's Caroline Lewis.
Caroline.
I'm down in Miami with the Clio Institute at Pinecrest Gardens.
Great.
But I'll email you and let's follow up.
Caroline, I'd be happy to do that and to pursue the conversation about NAI as well. That's been something that I've thought about and my colleagues have thought about periodically, and so... I'd be very pleased to make that connection. That leads me to something I didn't announce at the beginning, but one of the questions we have is what is the sort of interest level or appetite from within the informal science education community for the kind of work that we're doing? And in order to get a measure of that, at least a cursory assessment, we've developed a SurveyMonkey survey, and if this group recommends that it be okay, I would send a link to that survey to the Climate Literacy Network list and invite and encourage anyone from informal science education centers to click on that link and spend about less than 10 minutes, maybe more than five, filling out a survey related to this work.
Yeah, no, that John, this is Tamara. Go ahead. That would be great.
I will send that to
Stephanie. So it, depending on you know what you know is in the survey, if there's a particular if you want it to focus people responding who are explicitly part of informal science learning informal science groups, indicate that, or if you want broader input into the survey, indicate that also.
Okay. Thanks. I'll do that.
Okay, and John, this is Tamara. I also have a question about your study circles. The participants, I assume, are interpreters from the various partner aquariums or other informal groups you're involved with. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually...
I guess... Go ahead.
The first study circle was all representative of aquariums. The second study circle was intentionally broader than that. We have... some zoos, some aquariums, and some groups that are actually, I would call, other, that don't necessarily even have an exhibit venue per se. For example, Mass Audubon, they do have some exhibits, but they do a lot of outdoor work. The Island Institute, which works more with teachers and with the fishing community along the coast of Maine, so they don't even have exhibit venues. And one of the Sea Grants is represented. And so we intentionally said, let's see what happens when we broaden, because we want to learn from that. And this is intended to be a learning process.
So I guess the question is since you're thinking in terms of longer term sustainability of the conversations or interactions of particular study circles, is there a particular theme or community or something that sort of ties a particular group of people together? I guess, for example, like you said, the first one was aquariums, and that sounds reasonable for a first step. But maybe you have an aquarium, but other informal science kinds of institutions in Texas, and might a regional focus be facilitated that could have some kind of a sustaining addressing issues that are local. and could potentially there be other kinds of things that, or have you been exploring that at all into ways that would naturally tie a group together in some way
that would help
facilitate their
training? Yeah, there are a couple of issues there. One is what's the theme of our project, and our project theme is really related to oceans and coasts. So in our application process for the second study circle, we asked, you know, we have people from Utah, so they're inland, but they have an exhibit that relates to the ocean. So we wanted to make sure there is a connection to oceans and coasts. So that's one part of the answer. Another question that relates to what you asked is, looking ahead, does it make sense to continue working with groups that are sort of from institutions spread across the country, or would it make more sense to work with groups regionally? And I think in the short term, it's important to keep working at a national level, but in the long term, it's going to be more sustainable and sensible to work regionally. So I think there are a lot of advantages to working regionally, but I think we need to establish networks that are connected nationally and build a core that has a kind of a national reach, and then reinforce that core, but increasingly move towards more regional activities, so that our study circles in the future might be, you know, in the greater Boston area or the greater Philadelphia area or what have you. They could be in different mm-hmm. places around the country. And that's something we're wrestling with.
Mm-hmm.
Did I answer your question?
Yes, I think so. In terms of the connections to the other CSEPs, a lot of them are regionally focused. So it seems to me that a natural avenue for you, once you've sort of put this model into place, is to partner potentially with another CSEP that has a regional focus and create the component focus on oceans and coasts within their regional network, addressing the issues that are regionally important. That's just a way I was thinking of it. It might facilitate that interaction in getting into address it, because I agree, having this national connection, but then allowing the regional communities to build, it could be very well a mechanism for sustaining the conversations.
Thanks.
Are there other questions for John?
This is Andy. I just wanted to say I wasn't really sure what social math was, so I Googled it while y'all were talking, and Frameworks Institute came up. So I just wanted to say the website is frameworksinstitute.org, and they have a great video on there about social math. So a lot of the concepts you were talking about seem to be on that website, and I'm really thankful for that resource, so I'll be looking through that. Thanks, John.
You're welcome. I do recommend it. There's a lot there that is accessible. So check it out if you're intrigued.
Yeah, and they do seem to be a nonprofit. And I clicked on the About page, and they said, you know, they've presented at the White House about teenagers. So I guess their whole thing is about how to communicate social issues. That's the research
yes.
focus of the group.
I think it's important to acknowledge that this work is supported by NSF, and it's building on work that was supported by other federal agencies, the Institute of Museum and Library Services and NOAA, and we appreciate that support enormously. It's I feel like we're onto something. I think there's evidence that we're onto something, and so I appreciate the government support to help us get going.
Now, where are you in the grant, John?
We have through August for this current grant. We are working with our second study circle, which is all we've budgeted for, but then, as you pointed out earlier, we also want to be collecting data about what then happens with visitors. So our evaluation work will continue after the study circle, and so there's more work to be done. But and then of course, as many people will be, we are expecting an RFP to make a proposal to take what we've learned and create a longer-term plan for doing something built from the lessons of this work.
Got it.
Any other questions or comments?
No, this has been very helpful.
Okay, well, John, thank you very much. I think it's given us a lot to think about. I also appreciate your last slide, which has the links to some resources. I think some of them we actually had talks on from the American Psychological Association a couple of years ago. So it provides us a very important connection for the various people who participate in the Climate Literacy Network. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Cameron, everyone, thank you so much, and I hope I can get on these calls more often. I keep not being able to, and I really want to. So I really appreciate the opportunity to share.
You're missing out a lot, John, so we need you on board. They're really potent. They're excellent
conversations. We do have very good conversations. In addition, if you do miss one, you already know we recorded, and the recording will get posted with the slides. So, and I've actually done this myself for a couple of presentations. I've gone back and listened to the presentation and the slides, and then contacted the presenter if I had any questions later. So anybody can go ahead and do that. The recording gets posted almost right away. We get it within a couple of hours, and Scott, I think you post it within the day. So
as I can.
So it's available for anybody to look at if you can't make the call. But we would appreciate anybody who wants to come in and contribute to the conversation to actually make the call, because they are very rich conversations.
Please.
Okay, so we'll end now. I want to wish everybody a happy holiday. We will have our call next week. We don't have a presentation scheduled, so we will just have informal discussions for anybody who is around.
Thank you so much, Tamara. You have a good holiday,
right.
Too.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.